Backers call it the right to work. Opponents call it the right to work for less. Those of us who follow the General Assembly call it the most contentious issue to hit the State House in a long, long time. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, an expert panel debates the bill at the center of the dispute. A measure that, simply put, would prohibit employers from entering into labor contracts that require workers to pay dues to the unions that represent them. Why have Republicans made the so-called Right to Work bill their top legislative priority? In the face of $1,000 a day fines, just how far are House Democrats willing to go to block the proposal? And will next month's Super Bowl turn into a highly publicized super brawl, figuratively at least, between organized labor and the bill's supporters? All that and more on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park. Four locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park. The idea economy is here.
Joining me for what promises to be a heated yet informative discussion are four people who know this issue inside and out. Republican Representative Jerry Torr of Carmel, a longtime advocate of right-to-work legislation and the author of this year's House bill. Democratic Senator Jim Arnold of LaPorte, chairman of the Chamber's Minority Caucus and an outspoken critic of the measure. Kevin Brenniger, president of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, which represents more than 26,000 businesses. And Jim Robinson, director of United Steelworkers District 7, which encompasses Indiana and Illinois. And I thank you all for being here for what I'm thinking will be a rather lively discussion. Jerry Torr, let's start with you. You have introduced some version of this legislation since, what, 2004, I think?
2004, that's right.
Longtime advocate. Why your passion for this bill, and why is it that this seems to be the year that your Republican colleagues have jumped on the bandwagon, if you will?
Well, two reasons, really. The first is the freedom for the individual worker to decide whether or not he or she wants to associate with the labor union. And the second is, I'm convinced that there will be more employers. Look at Indiana, we'll have opportunity to bring more jobs here. IEDC does a really good job of closing, and they close about 70% of the deals they get to work on. So the more times they can get at bat, the more employers will come to Indiana, and the more the 250,000 Hoosiers that are out of work will have jobs.
Now, you represent Carmel, of course, which is not known as a bastion of organized labor. Is it odd? What should we read into the fact that somebody who represents a largely white-collar area that doesn't have a lot of union representation or union shops within the boundaries of your district, does that at all seem odd that they would be coming from your desk, this legislation?
Oh, I don't know. I think that happens largely because Paul Manweiler, when he was minority leader and I was first elected, put me on the labor committee. And at that time, 1997, I really didn't know much about labor issues, started learning. And so it's just from the experience on the labor committee, I think.
So the geography is
right.
You shouldn't read too much into that,
right.
I suppose. Senator, you have said that this is probably not the time that this needs to move forward. You said if the governor, and I'll let you address this, but in a state of the state, he bragged about how Indiana has become a destination spot for many companies across the country, and I think your response was, if that's the case, why do we need this legislation?
Well, John, exactly right, and I to allude to what my colleague, Representative Torr, just mentioned. It. He said that 70% of the time we've been successful, and we feel we can be more successful than that. I think 70% is a record to be envied. My question remains, I've been on pensions and labor since I've been in the Senate in 2007. I was on the Summer Study Committee with Representative Torr, and I'm on the Pension Labor Committee now. And all throughout the testimony that we've heard this past summer, and including as late as yesterday in the Pension Labor Committee, I still have heard nothing. I've heard nothing that would give me concrete evidence that we need to change the position Indiana's in right now. I mean, according to Dan Hassler, Economic Development Director for the State of Indiana, he says that Indiana attracted 219 companies last year, almost 20,000 jobs. I think that's great. I think that we've done a great job, and the governor has now given him a goal of 250 for this year. I think it speaks loudly that Indiana is addressing the issues, And why are we taking on an issue of the hardworking union people in this state that have built this state on the backs of their hard work and effort? Why are we taking on a struggle at this time to kind of demean them and after they struggled so hard to give us a 40-hour work week and workman's comp and paid vacations? You know, I think Indiana is a place to be envied. I think it's fine just the way it is.
And let me ask, you the same question, follow-up question I asked Jerry Torrey. He's from Carmel, and he's supporting this legislation. You're
sure.
From LaPorte, which enjoys much more union activity than certainly suburban Indianapolis. Is this a must for you, given your constituency, your position?
A must as far as know what it means.
Well, as far as your opposition and a must that you oppose this because of the people you represent.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was sent down here by the people of District 8, and that's the blue-collar workers and agricultural workers predominantly. But, you know, it goes beyond that. I'm a business person. I believe in business. People have invested their time and their money to make businesses successful. We have to support them, the same as industry and the same as agriculture. And it isn't a fight that needs to be taken at this time. And I think it's very unfortunate the people of Indiana are being subjected to this at this time when there are so many other issues that we could be addressing that need to be addressed.
Kevin Brenniger, you heard Senator Arnold say he hasn't heard throughout this entire debate any concrete evidence to support the position of those who want to see this legislation become law. Can you provide him with any empirical data, any concrete evidence that would satisfy him?
Let me first address the IEDC. Data and follow up on the previous two comments. IEDC tells us that they have a two-thirds...
Again, this is the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, which is basically the recruiters
the
of companies.
For the state of Indiana. That they're successful in somewhere between two-thirds and 70% of all the projects they get to compete on, and that was over 200 deals that they successfully brought into Indiana last year. But they also tell us that fully 30 to 50% of the deals they don't get to compete on. If we were able to have 50% more deals and have a 70% success rate, that would be roughly between 70 and 80 more businesses we would have brought into Indiana and all the jobs that come with that during 2011. So we're competing with one hand tied behind our back. And we could be doing a lot better. And when we have a 9% unemployment rate, I would respectfully disagree with Senator Arnold that where we are now is good enough. It's not good enough. We need to be doing everything possible to help those 270,000 unemployed Hoosiers find jobs and good-paying jobs.
These 80 companies that apparently, by your calculation, didn't come here, didn't even consider mm-hmm. Indiana. The governor was on our show last week, and I asked him this question. And I know organized labor has been asking this question as well. Can anybody name some of these companies? The governor did.
He said
Hyundai and I believe Volkswagen were
yeah.
two.
Yeah.
That leaves 78 others. Can you add to the list? Are there any others among those 78 that you
well,
can?
Well, we know that, I believe it was Procter & Gamble in Jeffersonville that was here. They were expanding and looked at doing that in their existing facility in Indiana or Tennessee. They chose Tennessee, and they specifically stated to the media publicly that the reason was because Indiana wasn't a right-to-work state. We're not able to just give you a list of those because the site selection consultants who assist these companies in making those decisions operate under confidentiality contracts and provisions in their contracts. And so if they provide that information, they're violating their contract and they're subject to being sued. So that's why, there's somebody, the governor or no one else can't just try to list because it's a violation of the agreement between the site selection consultant and the client.
Jim Robinson, you're probably wondering if we were ever going to get to you on the panel here. You went to work, I think, for Inland Steel in 1971. You quickly became involved in organized labor and you've been active ever since. Now you oversee, of course, United Steelworkers for the two-state region I mentioned. You've seen a lot of ups and downs in the battle between organized labor and the business community over the years. Where does this threat, what you, I presume, would perceive a threat to organized labor, how does it compare with the other things you've seen over the past 40 years?
Well, as you say, it's been up and down. We fought huge battles to save the steel industry. We fought some major battles in fending off attacks by big companies like Bridgestone Firestone. But I want to go back to this argument that companies won't come to Indiana because it's not a right-to-work state. And we don't really know that's true. We're just told to take it on faith because some company said it or some site selector said it. The management people that I deal with, and I used to deal with middle management out in the mill, and now I deal with company presidents and CEOs, they're all data-driven engineer and CEO type, or MBA types. They don't make decisions on, most of them, don't make decisions on gut instinct or ideology. And if the issue with Indiana is it's not a right-to-work state, the question is, what concrete benefit does right-to-work bring to the company? Why would you not locate in a state where otherwise it makes perfect sense to be because of right-to-work? What is that going to take away from the bottom line? The management people that I deal with, they think about the bottom line. They think about their shareholders and they think about their investors. They don't think about some ideology about free riders and freeloaders. In fact, most of the management people I deal with where we have union security clauses, they don't want this fight in their plants. They don't want a huge divide opening up where people are fighting out on the job over who's a scab and who's a union member. They want people focusing on quality, efficiency, and production, which is what we negotiate to do because we know that an efficient, high-quality, productive plant is a profitable plant that can afford good wages and benefits for our members.
We'll see. Please respond. I mean, you are the business community.
By noting that Indiana CEOs do care about this issue and are aware of it. The IEDC, again, Indiana Economic Development Corporation, early last year did a survey of 90 CEOs within the state of Indiana. They gave them a list of 10 frequently cited important site selection criteria and asked them to rank those from most important to 10th most important. Right to work was one of the 10 choices. Those 90 CEOs collectively ranked right to work as third most important out of that list of 10 most important site selection criteria.
So where's the benefit? What does it do for the bottom line?
Well, does anybody want to say what it does for the bottom line?
I think probably one of the reasons some employers want to go to a right to work state is because they probably believe that if their union can't have a security clause, the union may not be quite as interested in trying to organize the workers. And it's not about lower wages like the unions want to make it. It's about negotiated work rules, and business owners want to be able to run their companies the way they think is most efficient, not the way a group of employees want to negotiate, where sometimes they have to hire a couple more employees because under the contract, somebody's not allowed to pick up a broom, and so now all of a sudden the line is down for 20 minutes when it could have been down for 5 minutes.
But couldn't most efficient also be construed as doing away with certain safety restrictions or provisions that...
You've got federal laws
You think federal law takes care of the center line?
I mean, we've come a long way in that regard.
Federal law, OSHA, and also, you know, the workers' comp insurance carriers, workplace safety is
off the table.
Yeah. I just want to throw this in here. First of all, when we talk about polls, I sat on that committee, again, as Representative Tor did. You know what, and I made this comment, my argument the other day on this floor of the Senate when I cast my vote no against it in the Summer Study Committee. You know, I'm a firm believer, after over 40 years of public service, I'm a firm believer that polls will give you any results you want if you're paying for it and you frame the question the way you want to frame it, number one. And number two, we talk about site selection. A gentleman from site selection was up there and spoke at our committee that day, and he was spoken brought in by the people for right to work. And I asked him specifically, and according to our own IEDC director, Indiana ranks sixth, according to Site Selection Magazine, in the United States. And I asked him, would you say that's pretty good? He said, I'd say that's very good. So site selection apparently is not a big issue as what people trying to propose or trying to make it out.
If your kids came home with a B on their report card, did you tell them that's okay, you're working hard enough, don't work any harder? Or did you tell them an A is better, let's try a little harder?
Good point.
A quarter of a million Hoosiers out of work, we need to be doing everything we can do to bring more jobs to Indiana.
Okay, well then,
And all the states above us in that particular ranking and many others are right to work states. And
isn't it more of a mixed bag? Some of the states are right to work, and others are not. That are, if you look plot it out on job creation, it's a mixed bag.
On the site selection ranking, was referring to, all the states above Indiana were right to work states.
Fifth or sixth is pretty good, but why wouldn't we want to be one or two?
I'm sorry, Jerry. Let's get away from this issue about statistics about right to work states and non right to work states, because nobody's ever been able to establish there's a real link between job creation and right-to-work states and the fact that they're right-to-work. Nobody's been able to do that. So all we're doing is arguing about this state, which happens to be a right-to-work state, and this state, which happens to not be a right-to-work state, and who's got better job creation. Nobody can prove that it's right-to-work that does it.
Prove that it's not right-to-work.
I agree. So let's drop that, and let's talk about whether this is good public policy. Here's what right-to-work does. It says to unions and employers in the private sector, you are prohibited from negotiating something that the two parties at the table may come to an agreement is in their best interest in those negotiations. Right, that's the first thing.
Affecting a third party, the employee.
But the employee is there, the employee is there because the employee applied for a job. Sure. And the employee is working in a union shop which either was organized after he got there by a majority or was organized before he got there. He chose to apply for that job. And if the employees in that location don't want to be union, they have a legal federal law right to vote the union out. So what right to work says is the company and the union can't negotiate a particular contract provision that they conclude in negotiations is what they want to do. And it says to the union, you are obligated by federal law to spend resources to represent all employees equally, but certain employees get to choose not to contribute to the welfare of all in this particular, you know, as a minority.
Jerry Torr, respond.
If we had the power at the state level, I would be happy to change the law so that the union didn't have to represent somebody who chooses not to be a member. I agree that's not fair, but that's federal law. We can't do anything about that. And my understanding is every time Congress starts talking about it, it's the unions that throw a fit and say, no, we want to keep it this way.
Let me ask a
right. Well, and keep in mind, if I'm someone in a right-to-work state and I have a grievance and I've already chosen not to belong to the union, I'm not going to, in all likelihood, go have the union represent me. I'm going to go seek my own representation.
Actually, that's very much not true. I can tell you from personal experience, some of the loudest who demand the union represent them are people who in right-to-work states, or in Indiana we have a couple of plants where we don't have union security clauses. Some of the people who are the loudest about you have to represent me are the people who are non-members and don't pay. We have a local in Indiana that just spent $8,000 taking a grievance to arbitration for a non-member who was discharged because the local union decided that that was their obligation on the merits, lost the arbitration, and some of the union members dropped out of the union because they didn't like this guy and they didn't like their money going to represent this guy who wasn't paying.
And you guys,
this creates this kind of division in the workforce that is contrary to everything that we know about modern manufacturing, which is about teamwork.
That's right. And you guys should go to Congress and try to get the law changed so that the union doesn't have to represent non-members.
But why are you guys messing with it in the meantime when you know what the result is?
Because it still boils down to two parties making a decision that affects and takes away and the third party's individual freedoms.
But my individual freedoms are being taken away by the legislature. These guys got elected to represent me. I'm the third party, and no, I don't get a vote on this.
Rhetorical question. Are there some jobs not worth seeking? I mean, you talk that so much of this is about attracting jobs. I'm guessing, and I'm not in this the field of attracting businesses, but I'm guessing, let's say, state X, Y, or Z. If you want to get businesses, you do away with environmental permitting, you do away with clean air, clean water standards, you do away with workers, UD's worker comp regulations, and you probably have people flocking to your state But that doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that you would want those jobs? I mean, is that a cockeyed suggestion?
Of course you're
right.
Well,
of course you couldn't do that because all the things you just ticked off are federal law that apply to all 50 states.
Well, you know, I still have not been shown any empirical data that this is needed. And why we took on this fight in 2012, when the governor himself, in a letter that he sent to some of the people back in 2004 when he was a candidate, first candidate, that there was no need for right to work in Indiana. Now, what has changed in 2004 to 2012 that we need to address this?
Our unemployment rate has doubled.
No. Well, we understand it, and we can always be better. You know, I don't care if the unemployment rate's 1%. We can always do better, and it's a goal. But we have been trying to address it.
You talk about the timing of why in 2012. Let me bring up one other wrinkle here with timing, and that is the Super Bowl. We've talked about this with your counterparts on previous shows. The suggestion is that Republicans want to get this done before crowds converge on Indianapolis for the February 5th game when the national spotlight is here. And in the meantime, we now see the NFL Players Union getting increasingly involved and saying that they're willing to stage protests and do sorts of, I don't know if their word was civil or phrase was civil disobedience, but legal protests and so forth. Is that a concern? Does that alarm you, Jerry Torr?
I think if organized labor did anything to disrupt any of the Super Bowl events going on the first weekend of February in Indianapolis, I think that'd be a real shame, and I think it would reflect very poorly on them.
Senator, what do you think?
Well, I'd like to tell you this. We are fooling with people's lives and welfare and their incomes. And when you do that, you're going to take their most sacred trust and their sacred possession away from them. People are going to react. I would hope we wouldn't have to resort to this. I certainly wouldn't want to, because we want people to be proud of Indiana. We want the nation to look, when they cast this light on us, to be proud of us. But you know what? It's hard to say. I've been in law enforcement for 36 years. And you know what? When people start losing their homes or start losing their incomes, start losing their jobs, their children go hungry, people react in strange ways. And we hope we don't get to that
point. They're doing that because they're unemployed right now.
Well, yeah. I can't blame everything on unemployed. We got some people out there, Jerry, that I want to tell you something. They wouldn't work. They wouldn't hit a lick of work if you paid them $40 an hour because it's too easy to steal and sell drugs.
Unfortunately, speaking of timing, we're out of the allotted time we have. I promised that we'd have a heated discussion, but an informative one, and I think we were right on both counts. I appreciate all of you being here for this discussion.
Thank you.
Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Jerry Torr of Carmel, Democratic Senator Jim Arnold of LaPorte, Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Jim Robinson of the United Steelworkers of America. Proving once again that all politics is local, an expert panel tackles local government reform on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter, Indiana Legislative Insight. Well, Ed, for those who haven't been following every twist and turn in this ongoing debate, started with a protracted caucus meeting by House Democrats. Then we had a filibuster, a timeout, tentative agreement, a blow-up of that agreement, now the assessment of $1,000 a day fines, and basically an impasse. Is that a fair assessment of where we've been so far?
Sure, that's what we call Tuesday at the legislature. This is starting to resemble more world wrestling news than anything else.
Well, we're set the stage for us for these next few weeks, which promise to be very interesting, very important because of the Super Bowl, among other things, as we mentioned during the roundtable.
Absolutely, and nobody knows what's going to happen. The two leaders of the House don't know, and things change based upon whatever happens at a given moment. Things can change at a drop of a pin, and we've been seeing that over the past week. So we really don't know what's happening, whether Democrats will participate in committee hearings from one day to the next, will be there for floor action one day to the next. And there are a lot of other issues beyond right to work that are being stalled as a result.
And I want to get to that, but this notion of a referendum, Democrats said that's one of the amendments that they wanted to offer. Then Legislative Services Agency, the nonpartisan bill drafting group, said, nah, I can't really do that under Indiana's Constitution. So that's why Democrats said they wanted more time, and that's something that House Speaker Brian Bosma, Republican, is not willing to give them. So we get to these fines. Are the fines going to get anybody's attention, or is that just going to add fuel to the fire?
Well, one thought that the fines were going to be important. Democrats were very wary of them coming into the session, but even coming into this last week. But earlier this week, they seemed to get some new resolve and seemed to be willing to stay out, even having to pay those fines. And now they're going to court to try to stop them again. Good
luck. Anybody's guess what a judge will do in terms of inserting himself or herself into the legislative process.
But there may still be a way to get the Democrats back and participating. There's talk of different kinds of amendments coming up that would be...
And I'm guessing some of the other bills, because when things stop, they stop, according to Brian Bosma, on everything. And there are a lot of bills that Democrats actually want to see move. Is that right?
Absolutely. Bills and principles. And if the Republicans can come up with a way to... Perhaps insert some education funding from that found $320 million that the governor came up with in December into some other bill. It may embarrass the Democrats, may give them incentive to come back, and they don't want to be seen as voting against or not being there to support one of their key constituents and also to support a key issue, education, that they have been talking about incessantly for the last 2 years as the governor has been, in their words, cutting it.
I can almost hear those attack ads now. Thank you, Ed. Appreciate, as always, your insight. For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Lawmakers under News. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwantes. We're back again next week. Until then, take care.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park at Ameriplex, Indianapolis. Set on 80 acres near the new International Airport, the Purdue Research Park at Ameriplex, Indianapolis. The idea economy is here.